Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 346. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
I'm here once again, Johnny, for your pleasure.
As always? As always.
James Jones.
As always.
As often we'll do.
As often. I wouldn't even go that far. As occasionally.
And Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I have jumped out of a plane and survived to tell the tale.
Nicely done, sir. I hope that was enjoyable for you.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was nauseous the whole time. Yeah, let's not speak of it, really.
Okay, we won't. So we are here to talk about Nintendo with you, and we're going to have, I think, a somewhat abbreviated new business this week so that we can focus a little more on emails, because people answered the call, and we have been getting some really excellent emails that are very wide-ranging in the topics, and we're not going to get them all today, but I'm hoping to get a few of them, and then we'll catch up on more next time. So anyway, let's kick it off with the biggest release in a long time for Wii U, and that would be Pikmin 3. It's only been out for about 3 days as of this recording, and so we are not deep into it yet, but Guy is going to kick off the discussion of Pikmin 3, a game that will surely come back around in subsequent weeks.
Yeah, I haven't had time to... Actually, like you said, Johnny, before the show, that you played up until day 8. I've only played up until day 6. I did restart a couple of days, so but I'm not as far as along with you. Unfortunately, my week was pretty busy, and I haven't had time to sink my teeth as much as I would have liked into the game. So yeah, here are some superficial impressions. And what is more superficial than talking about how freaking nice the game looks? Am I right?
Yeah.
I just seeing Pikmin in HD, I think, was worth the wait. And I think that Nintendo is being more, I don't know, like they're trying more things with the way that the cinematography, I suppose, that you could call it. You know, like you've got these titles like Exploration, Day One, and the camera will zoom in and go through the O of Exploration, and you know, like you'll see the little ship that your characters are using to pilot in space, and you know, like it's just like a really surprising presentation, in my opinion.
I think the spaceship stuff is definitely a nice surprise for me. I don't remember them ever really showing that off in the demos.
No, and you see like the blue planet just you know, at the bottom of the screen. It looks very, very nice. Like it looks so peaceful and so cool.
And the inside of the spaceship looks really good too, which I definitely had not seen before the final game. So it mostly made me feel like, wow, I wish they would kind of do a game that's set in space.
Oh yeah,
because that the rocket plumes coming out of the vehicle as it launches off the surface, and it's there's something very flashy and really, really attractive about it in a way that I haven't really seen before in a Nintendo game.
Yeah, like I won't lie, it reminded me of something that perhaps Retro would do with Metroid. That's the first thought that I had.
Even Mario Galaxy a little bit, just in the sort of bombast that you get when they take off the planet. And I was thinking back, like, I'm pretty sure at least in Pikmin 2, they did sort of, you know, go up to space every day, but I don't think they really showed much of that. It was really just kind of like a menu screen. And there's much, it's like you said, it's much more cinematic in Pikmin 3. You really get a lot of that in-between stuff. So and they show it every time, but I always like watching it. Like, I think you can skip it, but I don't want to because it looks awesome.
So yeah, the game looks really good. I don't know if everyone who's listening has played a Pikmin game before, but this is definitely...
I can tell you that's not true.
John's never played one before.
No, actually, I never have.
Oh, okay.
John's never actually played a video game before.
No, I play only marbles. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Competitively, though. I play competitively in tournaments.
Yeah, of course. No, the game is more Pikmin. It definitely plays like the previous Pikmin games. You're controlling your avatar, this little character. Actually, this time you're controlling three of them. Captain Charlie, there is Alfie, the engineer of the ship, and Brittany, the botanist. And so turn by turn, like you can switch between them, but first you have to find them. So the game opens and you are controlling Captain Charlie, and he notices that he's on a strange planet, and oh, like, what's this? Pikmin. And he tries to make them, you know, to shoo them away with his whistle, but of course they just come toward them, and they're very attentive to all of his commands, and so Captain Charlie realizes that something's up here, that someone has domesticated these Pikmin, and that he can use them to do his bidding. But soon he's overrun by creatures, and then you move to the game proper. Like the sequence with Captain Charlie is kind of the...
it's a prologue.
Yeah. And then the tutorial goes on, but you're playing the game more than you were before. Like you're actually starting day one, and you're on a timer. You have, you know, from sunrise to sundown to accomplish different objectives. But for the first few days, you are very much like your hand is being held, and you have to look at the tutorials, and they explain to you how to pluck Pikmin out of the ground, you know, how to send them on enemies, which color of Pikmin has what attributes. And so it's kind of a slow start, but you, like, if you know what you're doing, you can go ahead and skip past the tutorials and try to accomplish as much in the day as you could, as you would in the previous games. In this game, instead of finding knickknacks, like quote unquote treasures, which was really in the previous games like garbage that Captain Olimar would find around, this time you're on a quest to get fruit, which is apparently the sole source of food on your planet, and apparently you're running out of fruit, and that's why you're exploring space, and you find all these strange fruits on this planet, which is, you know, Earth. And so every time that you find a new fruit, like you get a wonderfully beautiful and very tasty looking fruit on your screen, and you can spin it around. Like, the attention to detail is just incredible. And then you see it turn into juice, and the juice just looks so tasty that I don't know. This game makes me hungry. It makes me salivate for juice. you know, like the writing is a big part of this game. Every time that you find something, every time that the characters interact between them, or like at the end of each day, you see some sort of they write in their journal what their findings have been, and so like the first time that you find a lemon, you know, it will be dubbed a face wrinkler, and I don't know, like it's all very, very cute. At some point, Alfie decides that he's gonna write an ode to the captain. And it's just so nonsensical, like, ode to the captain. Oh, captain, where are you? Can you control your hunger? Can you teach me? Oh, my captain, I have to work on my rhymes.
It's a tribute to Walt Whitman.
Yeah.
So I had a couple comments about it. I'm playing with the Wii Remote and Nunchuck, and I haven't even tried the gamepad or the Pro Controller yet. I probably will out of curiosity, and I think I might occasionally use the gamepad for some off-TV play, because it does support that. But I'm finding that the game controls superbly with the Wii Remote and Nunchuck. I mean, it seems like definitely the preferred way to play. It's the way that, you know, Nintendo has sort of been recommending that people play. And so I have no problem doing that. But when you do that, the gamepad functionality is pretty minimal. I mean, it shows a map, which is not that useful so far. Maybe I'm not using it properly, but the map doesn't really give you a good idea of where things are located. It just kind of helps you. It just zooms out the view a little bit, so you can kind of see, oh, should I go up or down here? But
right.
Not necessarily going to help you plot a course all the way across a level.
Well, I kind of think it does help when you're trying to multitask. Because you do see the fruit on your map. Like sometimes when you've spotted a fruit, but you haven't quite reached it, it will be clear on the map that it's there. And so like it can show you things that you didn't notice by, you know, because of the camera, maybe on the TV screen. Like if a fruit was up high. And, it can also, like you can use it to, basically send a team of, one character and a team of Pikmin to a certain place, like a kind of a waypoint system. So while they march to a place, you can just tap on the screen, tell them, go here. And while they do that, you take control of another team and you go at the other end of the map.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I haven't messed around with that yet.
Yeah, and once they reach destination, like they say, like, oh, I'm here. So like they alert you when that's done. And it's very useful when you're trying to multitask and do two things at once.
Yeah, sure. You know, a lot has been written this week with all the review embargo going up, and Pikmin 3 has been getting good reviews across the board, I think. But a lot of people are kind of mentioning that it feels like a pretty safe iteration on Pikmin 2. And I'm a little ambivalent about that. I mean, I kind of agree. In most respects, I think that is a little oversimplifying things. But yeah, I mean, it's very faithful. It is Pikmin 3. It is exactly, if you took someone who played Pikmin 1 and Pikmin 2 and said, write down on a piece of paper what you think Pikmin 3 will be like, they would probably come up with something that looks a lot like this game. And on one hand, I'm like, well, I'm kind of okay with that because it's been so long since Pikmin 2 that I'm certainly hardly burned out on Pikmin. You know, I mean, I'm happy to play more of it. It's been a long time, so I'm sort of rediscovering why I enjoy the series. And there are some very much appreciated refinements, like the motion controls and like a number of other little features, you know. But at the same time, in terms of wanting to have something that really feels like it sort of harnesses the power of Wii U and has me do things that can only be done on Wii U, this is not that game. And especially because I'm playing it with the Wii Remote and Nunchuck, I think Chris Kohler's review talked about this, that it essentially feels a lot like a Wii game. And of course, there was no Pikmin for Wii. I mean, they did those remakes, but those are the same games. They're just Pikmin 1 and 2 with different controls.
There's no Pikmin for Wii release, but this very well could have been Pikmin for Wii at one point.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think if this game had come out in like 2007 with the same controls, you know, with standard definition graphics, but otherwise a lot of stuff could have been the same. I think people would have been really thrilled about it because they were like, well, I'm really glad Nintendo's keeping the series around. There's really nothing else quite like it, especially on their platforms. And it seems like a really good fit for this controller because the pointer is such a great way to control these Pikmin and to move them around. So I think it would have been very celebrated and it would have been one of the most popular games on Wii. And I wonder if on Wii U, it probably won't reach those same levels because it really does feel kind of like a last-gen game. Just with nicer, I mean, by last gen, I mean, it feels like a Wii game with prettier graphics.
Yeah, but I don't think that style of game has been done enough on the Wii to feel like it's a last gen game. I mean,
it's been done on GameCube.
Sure, but like not with a pointer. And I think that a pointer does change things a lot. And like no one played that Overlord game on the Wii. But it was basically like the controls worked so wonderfully well and the game was just broken because it had no AI whatsoever. even the enemies, they would just freeze into place and not really do anything. And that kind of broke the game. But you know, like now that's the only example that comes to mind. Like even if we were to talk about Little King Story, that game didn't use a pointer. So I don't know, like I don't feel like this is a genre or this is kind of like these gameplay mechanics have been done enough on the Wii. So I don't have a problem, you know, instead of revisiting them now, just visiting them now.
I don't have a problem with it either. I'm just remarking that this doesn't exactly feel like a Wii U game. I mean, when they first showed the Wii U at E3 more than 2 years ago, this is not the kind of thing I thought I'd be playing on the system. And that's okay, but you know, it's just an interesting thought that I had as I was playing it. As I'm, you know, looking at my TV, I'm worried about where the sensor bar is, and I'm, you know, dealing with the damn nunchuck cord draping all over my leg or whatever as I try to lie down and play the game. And it's just like, wow, these are the same things that I dealt with 5-6 years ago when I was playing Wii games. And especially because Pikmin did essentially skip that console, it feels very much like I'm playing a Wii game. So, you know, in terms, I mean, I was just thinking, like, in the way that I use my Wii U, I've been playing Wii U pretty regularly ever since I got it. But I've been playing a lot of games on it that aren't really strictly Wii U games. You know, they're like ports from PC or some other system, or they're virtual console games, or, you know, actually I've been playing quite a few Wii games on it also. Like, I played through the entirety of The Last Story on my Wii U. And there have been a few other Wii games as well. So I've been using the Wii U a lot, but I don't really feel like I'm playing Wii U games on it very much. And with Pikmin 3, I'm still not. That's just kind of how I feel about it. And like I said, I'm just kind of ambivalent, because on one hand, I don't care. I'm playing Pikmin 3 finally, and I really like it. But on the other hand, this is not quite the creative injection that I think, you know, some of us would like to see on Wii U in terms of a game that really takes advantage of the hardware and does something really fresh and interesting with it that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, it certainly isn't that.
It probably never was going to be Pikmin 3, but the game, unfortunately, I mean, Pikmin is kind of a B-level franchise for Nintendo. I think the games have always been really top-notch quality, but in terms of sales and in terms of influence and in terms of fan hype for it, it's not one of their top franchises like Mario and Zelda. And I feel like because Wii U has been mismanaged so badly this first year on the market, it's being thrust in a place of prominence that the game itself maybe doesn't warrant, or that it's just not prepared to absorb the kind of attention that it's going to get. And I think people have expectations out of it that it may not be able to live up to.
Unless you were expecting Pikmin 3. I mean, like, if you wanted more Pikmin, you're definitely getting that. And that's kind of the approach that I had with the game. Like, I was not expecting this to be like the Wii U savior, or like the game that finally proves that the Wii U has a reason to exist. I'm just like psyched that it's more Pikmin.
I mean, I put it in that same kind of tier as like something like F-Zero. If F-Zero came out right now, that would be absolutely amazing and I would love it. But would I expect it to sell the Wii U? No.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, Guillaume, you said, you know, it's Pikmin 3. It's what you expected from Pikmin 3. And I think that says a lot about where Nintendo's at creatively with how they push their franchises forward through a sequel cycle. Because if you look at Mario 3 or Zelda 3 or Metroid 3, those are all games that are light years beyond the previous game in the series. And they look pretty much nothing like the first game in the series. Whereas Pikmin 3 looks almost exactly like Pikmin 1. It's just higher definition. And it plays exactly like Pikmin 1. And it does a lot of exactly the same things. So even though it's been over, I mean, you know, Mario 1 through 3 came out over a span of about 5 years. And Pikmin 1 through 3 came out over a span of 12 years.
Something nuts like that.
The lack of evolution here is a little bit disturbing in the grand scheme of just how Nintendo sort of takes care and curates their franchises nowadays. I mean, it's been a long time. I'm very happy to be playing Pikmin again, and it feels fresh primarily because it has just been so damn long since I played Pikmin. But if this had come out a couple of years after Pikmin 2, which it very easily could have, I mean, we probably would be complaining about just how much like the previous game it really is. And I'm just a little bit surprised that after 9 years since the previous game in the series, this one doesn't seem to do a whole lot more with the formula. Now, there's some tweaks. I'm not going to sell it short. You know, I think having a third character definitely opens up more possibilities, and being able to throw the other astronauts up to higher ledges, you know, definitely expands exploration. There's a number of things they've done to sort of refine it. It's not a cookie cutter thing, but all that stuff is pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. And that, I guess that's my point. It's not to take away from the pleasure of playing the game, but just in a strategic sense, or maybe even just in a creative sense, I have to wonder, like, I look at this game and I think, why did this take so long? And this game was in development for 4 years or something like that. Yeah. It's just hard for me to imagine, you know, I mean, this game is so, it just it really is very conservative in terms of moving the franchise forward or in terms of introducing anything new to the series.
That's true.
Just kind of surprised at just how faithful it is to the Pikmin formula.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, if some of the commentary about you know, disappointment that this is so the same is justified in part because it has been so very long that it seems like it really needs to... It even though it's not been... even though I haven't played it recently, something should have evolved. There's just sort of a feeling that, like... it really shouldn't have gone this long without something significant changing.
Yeah, significant shakeup in the controls or something, or, you know.
Right.
Like, the gap between Super Metroid and Metroid Prime was 8 years. And those, I mean, are radically different games. I mean, just kind of shockingly different. Whereas the gap between Pikmin 2 and 3 is 9 years, and they're almost indistinguishable from each other, especially if you were playing on an SD TV. So that's my only point. It's not something that I would take into account if I was reviewing the game, because I think the game stands on its own merits and it's a good game. It's maybe a great game, you know. But I just, again, kind of in a larger context, I look at this and I say, really? This is what you brought us after this long? And, you know, if it was coming out, you know, the week before a brand new Zelda game or a new Mario game or something, then I probably wouldn't think twice about it. I'd just be like, wow, that's awesome. But I mean, when it really is kind of king of the mountain right now, it's the only thing on Wii U worth talking about for a while to come. And certainly for the first time in a long time, it's a pretty safe sequel.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe they spent these 9 years experimenting with stuff and were just like, fuck it. None of this works. Let's go back to the original plan. I don't know. Like, it's true that it doesn't feel like there's many new ideas here. Like, just, oh, okay, two new types of Pikmin.
Yeah, I mean, they added two new types of Pikmin between Pikmin 1 and 2, and that was, what, 2 years?
No, it was 3 years. About 2.5, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, anyway, that's Pikmin 3. We will be talking about it more. I do really like it, and I'm excited. I wish I had more time this week to play it, but I've been trying to squeeze it in whenever I can. Why don't we move on to James?
Oh, okay. So I have two things to talk about, both of them on the 3DS download space. So as part of the Club Nintendo rewards this year, I actually hit Platinum this year, only to find that the rewards were relatively disappointing. So I went ahead and got Sakura Samurai is my choice, because, you know, I'd always heard kind of either people really like the game or people think it's kind of eh. So I went ahead and I got that because I figured, well, at worst, I'm stuck with a download game I didn't pay for that I don't really like.
Yeah, I talked about it in one episode. I don't know if it's the episode that my audio got deleted or not. But I did not enjoy it.
No, and I understand why some people think you just don't like it, and I understand why some people think it's great. It's got elements of other games that are, in my opinion, more successful at what it's trying to accomplish. There are serious, serious punch-out parallels here. There are, you know, parallels to really simple adventure games. There's a little bit of a brawler feel to it, a level-based brawler where you buy power-ups so you can eke your way through levels. You know, it's kind of an interesting mix of ideas into one game, and I'm okay with it. You know, I don't love it. You know, I beat it in, you know, a couple hours. It's pretty short, all things considered. For attempting to do the punch-out stuff, one thing I thought kind of weird is that the enemies don't really telegraph their moves very well, which you'd think, well, that's good, right? Well, kinda and kinda not. Some of the pre-warning gestures they give you are opaque as to what is about to happen, which makes a lot of times beating certain types of enemies just feel more like luck and less than about developing a skill and quick reflexes, because sometimes it's just not immediately clear what they're going to do. This is an especially true statement with some of the bosses, which, you know, you only really get a pretty short time to learn their attack patterns because they do so much damage per hit, and because they're usually at the end of really unnecessarily long boss levels. So, be that as it may, the game itself works out okay. The combat mechanics are fun. I like the speed at which a lot of the fighting takes place. It's nice to have this kind of twitch reaction kind of game. And if that whole interplay between giving you something to react to and your reaction time was a little bit better, you know, the depiction of it was a little bit better, I feel like it would be a really good game, just, you know, just kind of a reflex game, a reaction time game. It'd be just, it's not something you see a lot of anymore, so it'd be a nice place for it to occupy. And it just isn't quite there. So it's an okay game that just missed on some really basic stuff, which is a little upsetting. The other game I have, unless anybody wants to make any comments there, but the silence tells me that the answer is no.
The game was pretty forgettable.
Yeah, I mean, I will say though, I do like the art style. It's kind of a neat art style. I didn't like it when I first saw it. I think it was on a big display wall in their E3 booth, and I thought, oh, that looks stupid as hell. There was alternating with Dylan's Rolling Western, which I still think looks stupid as hell artistically. But seeing it in person, seeing it as sort of an interesting take on a particular style of Japanese paintwork, it's kind of a neat visual aesthetic they accomplish.
Sure.
Moving on to the other downloadable game I got. I've only had this for a very short time, so I won't have a whole lot to say about it. Despite the fact I'm still playing Project Cross Zone, which I'm at well beyond 30 hours at this point.
well beyond the stages of madness at this point.
It is a much longer game than I expected. I went ahead and used a little bit of eShop credit I had lying around to buy the Game Gear Classic, if any game on the Game Gear can be called such a thing.
Hey, shut up, man.
Shining Force 2, The Sword of Hanja, I believe is the correct pronunciation. Which is, I saw the review on the site. I don't remember who wrote it. We'll talk about it.
Maybe it was Andy.
Yeah, it may have been Andy. Maybe we'll talk about it in the next segment or not. I don't know. I haven't written the script yet. But, I've played Shining Force games in the past. We played one on the show. You know, I have some experience with the franchise. I understand what it is. I understand the era it came from. I've played lots of games of that era, of that style, including things like the original Fire Emblem from the Super Nintendo with, you know, like fan translation patches. These games have a lot in common. So I've played, you know, I've got experience with this genre, and I figured, you know, if it's a portable game of this genre that I can put on my 3DS, making it like the fourth, sure, let's give it a shot. So I'm only through a few levels. And my real immediate reaction to the game is just how really primitive it is. Now, obviously, this game came out in 91, so there's a good reason for that. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, I am playing Project Cross Zone, which is visually just hyperactive. Very recently went through the last Fire Emblem game, which is a much more close analog. And of course, it is sumptuously drawn game. I mean, art everywhere. It's constant deluge of artistic decision making that makes that game really stand out. This is going back to something I'm not used to. This is essentially 8-bit graphics, but with a color palette that seems almost weird. And I remember I've played Game Gear in the past. I had friends who had Game Gears. We'd go on bus trips and we'd play that for the first half hour.
Until it died,
thank you. And, you know,
that's what I'm here for.
I don't remember the Game Gear looking this nice. And I was thinking about it, and I think to myself, oh, it's because all those stupid screens we used to have on handhelds worked like shit.
Yeah, the Game Gear screen is abysmal.
Yeah, I mean, the original Game Boy screen's not great. I mean, I owned one. It's not good.
But don't worry, James. You can go in the options and make the screen as ugly as it was originally.
Which is the exact thing I wouldn't want to do. I was actually kind of surprised. So the graphics being relatively crude, the game is remarkably bright and colorful, which is cool. I mean, I'm enjoying that. The writing is equally hellacious. I mean, it is absolutely tragic, but it's kind of fun just to see this really poor, like near literal translations from Japanese that we used to get in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's back when they used to just grab anybody they could that could translate.
Yeah, and there's no lyricism to what they're saying at all. It's just like, we should go there. There they are. We need to go. And it's like, okay, great. Good sentences.
It was certainly, it was probably some guy over in Japan who had watched a lot of American news broadcasts.
there's a certain C-spot runness to it that
yeah.
is endearing because it brings me back to a time where I was totally on board with this. It's like, whatever, yeah, it's fine. But
Pug jumped up.
Yeah,
Pug jumped down.
Pretty much. But from a gameplay standpoint, since that's what we're really here for, it also feels very primitive. Now, I know that this is a simplified game because this was not originally a handheld series.
Well, in fact, I think Andy said in his review, one thing he likes about it so much is that it's easy.
It is remarkably easy. But the sheer lack of things that are explained is kind of an amazing experience. So the map just zooms, there's a cursor. And even when the AI moves, you see the cursor scroll across the screen to where the enemy is, select them when it's their turn, and then move them to a different screen.
Wow. That's ridiculously old school.
You can see the AI's movement box. You can just see the AI just leapfrog each other because they're programmed to only go so many spaces a turn, even though they can move further than that. So there's time of you just waiting for the AI to slowly march its ass over there.
Nice.
But you also get, so when you get to control, you move your character around, and if you cancel, you actually get to watch them walk back to where they were as opposed to just poofing over there. which is amazing.
Nope, changed my mind, go back.
I've done that like 4 times just because it makes me laugh. They walk over to where you put them, cancel, poof, walk all the way back. Oh, it's so good. You watch the cursor move too, it's great. But, the game itself, so you move characters around, you get what is essentially a D-pad of options, and they're all just filled in with 3 letters. So, alright, what does this one do? What does this one do? Oh, I guess this is magic. You know, there's serious, serious UI issues going on here that are just awful. And you think, well, yeah, because they're working on the Game Gear's really small screen.
It was hard to show text on Game Gear.
It was impossible. And I remember... I remember somebody had the Game Gear Batman, and it tries to fucking tell a narrative, and it was just laughable. They had like the big dumb Game Gear mirror and lights magnifying system 2X, where it was like it just snapped on like a face sucker that just went on top of the Game Gear and this big glass thing, and you still couldn't read it. So conceptually, it's like, well, why did they make this game? And then I realized, because it is kind of once you get past the fact that the game has no desire to tell you what the fuck is going on, it's okay. You know, it's kind of an enjoyable, it is really dumbed down, kind of like an early Fire Emblem, but even more primitive than that. I mean, I've not gotten to a point where there's more than like 6 characters on screen, 7, 8 characters. I mean, it's tiny numbers of people moving with no real indication of like how much health they have left, what they're doing, how, you know, who's gonna move next, what's the turn order, any of that. It's just all figured out. Figured out. You'll be fine. Just go. And I'm kind of enjoying it. You know, it's not good. I mean, I'll be honest. This game is old as shit. And it shows. I mean, it's got serious issues. But it's an enjoyable experience in and of itself to sort of see this really primitive version of a genre that I liked. And you can see that at that time period, there were a lot of people making those games. And it's kind of a neat experience to go back and see, like, wow, this is where we were.
I feel like this could be like a nostalgic experience for me just because I was so heavily like, well, I was, you know, I played a Game Boy when I was a kid, and those are the kinds of games that I grew up on, and like it seems like it has all the same flaws as those games I loved as a kid.
Totally. I mean, it's almost laughable to buy a portable game now. Like, It's almost dumb that Nintendo's even bothering with the virtual console for most portable games.
I disagree.
Because, like, who really wants to play the Game Gear version of Echo the Dolphin? Nobody does.
That's not what I would choose to release, but that is what Sega has chosen to release.
Much of the stuff on the virtual console for the handhelds right now, there's a handful of stuff that's, like, the really, really high-end stuff. The stuff that was a lot of late Game Boy stuff, Game Boy Color stuff. And then there's like this weird smattering of stuff that's from like when I got my Game Boy in like 90. And just god awful stuff where you go back and play it now and you think, oh my god, this is terrible.
I don't know. So some of those games are perhaps the most interesting ones. I was playing Sword of Hope 2, and it's not a good RPG, but I was like, oh wow, this is my childhood. This is awesome.
Yeah, you realize how much you put up with, right?
Yeah, the games are interesting in just like how completely reductionist and primitive they are.
Well, I got reductionist and primitive for you, James, coming
What's
up.
What's that?
Oh, let's take up this segue and run with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's Zork.
Yeah, baby.
Zork. Yeah, so you might ask, John, in these days of HD graphics.
In these days of graphics. In these days of things that don't involve just printing out your output on a fucking printer.
Touche, James. So in these days of graphics, why on earth would you want to play a text adventure? Or, I guess, I think as they are known nowadays, interactive fiction? Eh?
What?
Sure.
I think that's what they're now called. That's what the cool kids call them. But
it's basically a choose-your-own-adventure book coded into a software algorithm that flips the pages for
you. Only you don't know what your choices are. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's the great thing about it, right? So Zork, Zork is a very famous, for those of you who are below the age of 35 and don't know what Zork is, as you probably shouldn't.
Below the age of 70.
Zork was originally published by a company called Infocom back in, I think the original Zork came out in 1981, and it was a text adventure. It was followed by, you know, Zork 2, Zork 3, The Great Underground Empire, and I think Zork Return to the Underground or something.
Something like that. It's weird. I thought you were going to go with 70s for the original release day. I'm kind of surprised it's as new as 81, because there were definitely lots of video games with graphics in 1981.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. But they couldn't tell a story worth shit. I mean, go look at Adventure on the Atari. I mean, it's you fight a duck faced upside down question mark.
Yeah, that was the thing, right? People that wanted more story out of their gaming. I mean, at this time, everything was very... I mean, Pitfall was not even out at this point, I don't think. I think Pitfall was 82, and that was, I mean, that was the high watermark for graphics at that point. So Zork tells the story of you are an adventurer in the Great Underground Empire, and literally there is really no preamble. You are just stuck in the game. You load the game up, and actually kind of the background on how I kind of got on this.
Wait. First off, are you playing this on a Commodore 64?
No, I'm not. I'm actually playing this. I'm playing this on my phone, which I was curious. I was like, surely there has to be something that will allow me to play Zork on my phone. And sure enough, Frotz, F-R-O-T-Z or Z, is a program that you can use and you can find. I think actually all the Zork games are now public domain. I think they were released. I think they're actually owned by Activision now, and Activision released them. Activision came out with some Zork game a couple of years ago, so they made all of the really old text adventures public domain, so you can just find them. They're just floating around out there. So I got this Frotz program that where you can kind of you can download these archive files and play them, just like an emulator. And it, you know, brings up, it just shows you all the text on the screen, and you can, you know, it has a little field to type in your text and everything. So you start out and it just says on the screen, you know, it just says some text saying you are in a field. There is a White House over to the east. There's a forest over to your west. There is there's a mailbox here. And the way that you move around the game world, which actually is abstract, completely all in your head, is, you know, go east, open door. So it's all very simple. But this was really kind of, It's just interesting the timing of this game, because it reminds me, and I actually to experiment, I brought my wife into this, much to her chagrin.
soon to be ex-wife.
I played the first little bit of the game just by saying, okay, I want to do an experiment with you. And I told her kind of like the setup, how you kind of move around and everything, the kind of commands that it takes. And so, you know, I would just read off what the game told her, and then she would say, you know, what she wanted to do. It was so funny, because to me, you have to understand, when I was a kid, and even now, I find it just engrossing, just kind of being thrown into this fictional world and just kind of poking around and figuring out what to do because you're really not given any guidance whatsoever. She lasted about a half hour, and then she's kind of like, I could tell that she was just being nice to me and humoring me. And she was just like, oh, this is kind of boring. And I was like, okay, the Zork experiment failed. So it's interesting because, you know, the first thing I want to do is just – the first thing – I mean, obviously, there's no graphics. So the first thing you want to do is visualize it. How do you do that? Well, at some point, I'm going to get some paper and just kind of sketch out the world because, you know, everything is very – it makes sense, but you kind of lose track of where you are in the game world. But yet, at the same time, you have the sense that you – that there are boundaries. For example, you know, you go over – you go three steps west and there's a cliff that you can't – you know, there, you can't go that way anymore. Or you go, you know, four steps north and you hit a mountain range that you can't climb over. So there's stuff like that. So one of my little side projects is going to be to actually kind of maybe get, if I want to get really nerdy about it, I could get some graph paper. And actually,
you're already playing Zork.
Yeah. I suppose if I want to get even more nerdy about it, I could get some graph paper and kind of plot everything out because that's kind of what you really feel like doing. You know, you have to visualize it like a map. It's sort of like walking through an area that you have no idea, and you have to kind of – because there's puzzles, so you have to backtrack a lot. So, you know, you'll find something – you know, you'll find – you'll walk through one area, and it'll say there's a wrench here. And you can pick up the wrench, but there's really nothing you can do with it. And there's probably nothing you can do with it maybe in the next room or the next couple of rooms you go through, or, you know, you'll walk out into a field or walk, you know, through a stream or something like that. But eventually you might come to a dam and there's a bolt there. So it's turn bolt with wrench and then you see what happens. And you can die, and at which point you have to start the game over again. And you do actually accumulate a score. I'm not too sure how. It's kind of arbitrary. You know, you might get 10 points for doing this, you know, for walking into a certain room, and then you might get 5 points for performing a certain activity.
Stuff that's tangential to the actual success of the game.
Yeah, so...
So is there an online leaderboard?
Not yet. Okay. Not in this version. I'm hoping there is in the DLC. But yeah, I mean, it's...
It's delivered via 8-inch floppy disk.
I have to imagine the speed run of Zork would last about 2 minutes.
Yeah, that's it, right? I mean, you could completely automate it, because there is a set way to beat the game, period.
Right.
It's a simple set of commands that you could put in.
Yeah, I mean, you could write a computer program to solve Zork.
Yeah. Yeah. You absolutely could, because there's a set amount of commands that it will accept. And, I mean, you could brute force the game. You really could. But, you know, back in 1981, when this came out, I mean, that was, you know, this was a big deal. And really, I mean, for a lot of older gamers, it's really, they look back on this series with fondness, because one of the things that did really have going for it was the fact that it was really, really funny. And that was back when you really didn't have, I mean, like I said, there really weren't many games telling stories, and they weren't telling stories like this in such a witty manner where there's just, it's, you know, it's not just your typical sort of, you know, kind of riff on, you know, AD&D sort of theme with dragons and stuff like that. It's all just, a lot of it is pretty silly, where, you know, the emperor of the Great Underground Empire is called Lord Dimwit Flathead. And if you go into a dark area, you can be killed by a lurking Gru. And that's kind of like sort of a running joke. Like, you know, it's among nerds, you know, if you go into a dark area, you're going to be killed by a lurking Gru. Because it's just a kind of silly thing. It's just an arbitrary, just pretty much an arbitrary word that was made up to indicate a monster that kills you.
Right.
Yeah, just something that sounds D&D-ish.
Yeah, it's nothing that...
It's not a real thing, they just made it up.
Yeah. So the tone of the game is, it's very charming and very witty, and a lot of times it'll tell you if you input a command that you aren't allowed to do, and then you input the command again, it'll chide you with some witty comment like, what, you didn't believe me the first time? Sort of thing like that. So it's, you know, it's really endearing. And I think that's why so many players like it. So I downloaded Zork 1, Zork 2, Zork 3, and then Return to the Underground, or whatever the fourth game is.
And are you planning to play through them all, like without help?
I would like to, because when I was a kid, the one that I actually started with was Zork 3. And I was never able to really get all the way through it. I've reached a certain point, and I could still remember where that point is. It was a point with a compass rose, and at the time I didn't even know what the heck that was. So that was basically where it ended. So I've always had unfinished business with this series, but I always really had a soft spot for it in my heart. So that's kind of why I was like, I wonder if there's an easy way that I could play this.
Yeah, it's probably good training too, because I think there's a text adventure portion in Saints Row 4.
You know what? Nothing would surprise me about that game.
Really? That's pretty damn funny.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That game is just meth. It just this is what it's like to use acid.
Exactly.
You know, I think you could point to a lot of things about Zork that probably led. I mean, in some ways, it comes from Dungeons and Dragons because it is sort of like having this non-combat scenario with a dungeon master, and you're sort of having a conversation with this dungeon master saying, "Hey, can I pick that up?" And he says, "No, you can't do that." Can I attack the thing with my wrench? And he says, "Yeah, you could do that." The thing dies. You know, so it feels almost like a conversation with the game designer. And you're sort of probing the limits of what his scenario will allow. And at the same time, like the stuff about, you know, about it having a world that does have boundaries, and about this world having sort of descriptive elements, and, you know, you go through different pieces of it and you solve puzzles. I think, you know, a lot of that informs things like Zelda. So it's a really interesting piece of video game history for sure.
Just very interesting how things kind of evolve that way. Definitely through the focus more on text and storytelling to more kind of graphically and, you know, still telling stories, but probably in a different way. But I remember even all the way up until probably the mid 80s, I still had to manually graph, you know, maps for games. I mean, I remember actually, I think, I don't know what the first game was that had an auto map, like RPG wise, but when that came in, that was a big deal. Like, that was a big deal.
All right, guys. Well, let's move on. I wanted to talk real quickly about Cloudberry Kingdom, which finally came out the last week. It's out on Wii U and PS3 and Xbox 360 and PC, and it's coming to Vita at some point, and 3DS is still up in the air, I guess. But it's a game I've talked about before. We played it at E3 also and interviewed TJ Lutz, one of the developers there. It is a really fun 2D platformer, and it's procedurally generated, but in the final version also has a story mode. So in the story mode, you play through these pre-designed levels. So they have a little bit different pacing than the procedurally generated ones, because the ones that the computer designs for you, they usually feel like you're meant to just kind of blast through it without ever stopping. And I think part of the reason for that is that the computer, that's the way the computer would play it, right? So the computer would basically look for the path of least resistance and just keep moving. And it seems like maybe a little more challenging to design a computer AI that can learn to play through levels where you have to be more patient and you have to wait for certain windows of opportunity. And so maybe they didn't do that. Maybe they just made it so that every level is possible to just run through as fast as possible. And that's just the way they're made. So in the story mode, the levels do have kind of a different feel to them because they're more handcrafted. They look the same, and honestly, the graphics are not that great in this game, and that's not really the point. But the levels in story mode feel like they require you to be a little more observant and a little more patient, which is a hard adjustment if you're used to playing the arcade mode where everything's just made automatically and it's really breakneck pace. But it's nice, and they're done well, and there's some pretty devious little wrinkles that they throw in there in terms of placements of enemies and lasers and fire whips and things like that. But, you know, Cloudberry Kingdom is a game, I've been impressed with it from the very first time that I played it. I'm no less impressed with it now. I'm just glad that I have it on my Wii U. I mean, the off-TV play works really well. And it's a good choice for this kind of game because you don't get a whole lot out of playing this game on a big TV unless you're playing multiplayer. And that's another thing that I have not really had a chance to try out except for at E3 yet. But that's a game. If I can get some like-minded people over, you know, or even just anybody who's ever played Mario, you know, just if you've played Super Mario Brothers, you can play Cloudberry Kingdom. You might get a little frustrated with it because it gets hard very quickly, but the mechanics are super simple and it's all just very twitchy and it's all just kind of go on instinct. And the multiplayer is just so zany that I think almost anyone could enjoy it for at least a little while. But it's really fun. I mean, if you like really difficult platformers, get in there. And I haven't tried it yet, but I know there is a mode or a setting that you can turn on that takes away your jumping ability, and it just makes you flip up upside down back and forth. So it basically turns the game into VVVVVV, except that the computer will design levels for you for infinity. So if you really like VVVVVV and you'd like to play a lot more of it, Cloudberry Kingdom has that and much, much, much more. So there's many power-ups that are built into it. You've got double jump and you've got jetpacks and you've got all kinds of other weird stuff. And those things don't necessarily make the game easier, because whenever they give you a power like that, they also design a level with that in mind. So they actually require that you use it, which is something that a lot of 2D platformers don't do very well. You know, they try to make a level that sort of fits any number of different permutations that you might come in there, especially like, think of like New Super Mario Brothers U. There's so many different power-ups that you could potentially enter that level with, including baby Yoshis and penguin suits and propeller suits that aren't even really part of the main game. And they have to build a level that you can beat even if you don't have that stuff. And Cloudberry Kingdom, and so, I mean, it never feels like the level's really optimized for a certain power-up. There's one exception that I found in the Luigi DLC, where they give you a penguin suit, and then they make you use it really well, and that's one of my favorite levels in all of Mario. And Cloudberry Kingdom is, you know, really sort of deals with that problem very directly, because the computer AI assumes that you have whatever power you're going to have, and it designs a level around that. And it will do that for infinity. It'll never repeat itself. So it's just a game that, like, it's kind of hard to talk about in a sense, because there's not a real distinct start, middle, and end to it. It is so arcadey, but it's a game, it's very addictive. It's really well done. It's very challenging, but very satisfying to play also. And it's so simple that almost anybody could pick it up. And every time I play it, I just kind of get this creeping feeling that there's going to end up being some kind of weird cult built up around this game, because you can play it forever and it's a little bit different for every person who plays it. And it seems like such a good idea. Let's just make a 2D platformer that designs its own levels, so it never runs out of levels and you can play it forever. But the surprising thing about Cloudberry Kingdom is that they actually pulled it off and made it work, and they made it fun. And it does so many different things within that formula that I think people are going to be playing this for many, many years to come. And it's a game that probably hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention as of release, but I think it's probably one of the best things that exists on Wii U right now. And I think it's well worth picking up on any platform that you have that supports it. But I really do hope people will check it out, because I think it's a unique game and it's really, really fun.
Have you done much off-screen play?
Yeah, I've done a fair amount.
How does it feel?
It feels fine.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it feels great. Latency can be a problem if you get too far away from the system, I think. But it's also very transparent, because the things you can do in this game are so simple. You can move left and right and jump. There's not even a run button. So if there's latency, you'll know it right away, and then you can do whatever you need to correct it. But it's not like it's going to be some kind of invisible killer to screw up your gameplay session.
Okay. Yeah, that's always the concern for me.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think you guys should check it out, especially Guillaume. I mean, this is definitely right up your alley.
I'm not so sure about that. It's like the only 2D platformer that I'm not picking up this year. I don't really have a taste for brutally hard platformers, especially like procedurally generated platformers. It's not something that appeals to me.
Have you ever played a procedurally generated platformer?
No, but I've played VVVVVV, and the whole thing with having to be super precise because of spikes is not something that I'm like, oh, awesome, I'm going to do that. I don't know if I'm, you know, like very limited in my taste and has to be like, oh, it has to play like Mario or something like that. But there's something about these games designed for you to be super precise that I just I don't really care for.
Well, of course, this game has a scaling difficulty. So it starts off easy, and then as you play, it gets harder. And I think there are a lot of options in the arcade mode. So you can, I'm not sure if you can adjust how quickly it scales up, but I know that there are lots and lots of sliders. It looks like a Smash Brothers options menu. Like there's so much stuff on there. So I feel like there's probably a way for you to set it up that you would really enjoy it. And there's probably a lot of different ways that you could enjoy it. But I understand your concern. I think this does cater more to the Super Meat Boy crowd, to the VVV crowd, even to the Rayman Legends crowd, which I think is an insanely hard game. It's so pretty and charming. It's easy to forget just how ridiculously difficult it is. But you know, if you just got done playing New Super Luigi U and you thought it was too easy, then, this is a nice option to progress from. And honestly, I mean, in a lot of ways, I thought Luigi was too easy. Not saying that I'm like a super gamer or anything, but you know, I beat that game and by the end, I still had 60 or 70 1-ups. So, you know, I mean, there are plenty of times where it gets frustrating, but it's not like it's something I just barely survived. I plowed through that game. It's, you know, without a whole lot of problems, really. So, enjoyed it a lot, but I don't think it's the end all be all of difficult platformers by any means.
No, but it does give you a lot of 1-ups in almost every level. You get one or two or three, and yeah. I don't think it's really the metric that you should use to decide, like, okay, like this game was too easy.
Well, let me say, I rarely played a level where I died more than three or four times.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, so anyway, that's Cloudberry Kingdom, and before we go, I wanted to throw in one more thing. We haven't really talked about it, but the Shadow of the Eternals Kickstarter relaunched a couple weeks ago. It's not doing great. They're about one third of their funding goal. They've got half of the period left, about 2 weeks by the time this episode goes up. And I certainly think, I mean, I've seen bigger comebacks than this. I certainly think there's still a possibility that they're going to come out ahead on the end. They might barely squeak by. But I backed it, and I you know, posted about it on Twitter, and I got a lot of questions from people like, why would you do that? And I kind of wanted to address it, just not to defend myself, but just to kind of open up the conversation a little bit. Because it's an interesting topic, and it's something that I thought about quite a bit before I did it. I did not back it the first time before they pulled it. I didn't really like their plan. I think the idea of crowdfunding the first episode of a multi-episode series and hoping that the sales of the first episode fund development of future ones is a terrible idea and would not have worked out well for them.
Yeah, that sounds like a disaster.
And the reason that I backed it this time, frankly, has a lot to do with the fact that they got rid of that plan. So they have collapsed the whole thing, all the episodes that they were planning to do. They've collapsed it down into one game, just a single normal download game that they're saying is about 8 to 10 hours long. So a little shorter than Eternal Darkness, but not too much. That game's not crazy long either. I'm not sure exactly where I heard this, but I heard an interview with Dennis where he was talking about the game, and he was kind of describing the sort of the initial scenario, which is this interesting historical character of this female serial killer who wanted to, like, you know, be youthful. She wanted to have immortal youth, and she thought she could do that by bathing in the blood of virgins, and so she killed like hundreds of women.
Yes.
And yes. Just a super creepy, weird character who has some basis in fact. I'm not sure how much, but clearly they're going to take that and run with it and you know, fictionalize it also. But as he was talking about that, and as we were talking about sort of, you know, the idea that your character is going insane and that you're playing all these different characters and you're using magic and stuff, I thought, you know, Eternal Darkness, although not my favorite game of all time, is a game that I do enjoy a hell of a lot. And more than that, I feel like it's a game that is not, it's a kind of game that no one's really making, even now. You know, it's been more than 10 years since Eternal Darkness came out. And I think a lot of games were influenced by it. And we talked about all that when we did Retroactive on it a few years ago. But I don't really think anyone's tried to sort of recapture that lightning. And I don't know that anyone is really making games in that kind of setting and with that kind of gameplay. And I thought, you know, I would like to see them take a crack at it. And I think by putting up my money for the Kickstarter, I'm not even necessarily placing a bet that it will be good. I'm placing a bet that it might get made.
Well, you're not even, though, because if it's not made, your money goes back.
Yeah. Well, if it's not funded.
Well, actually, no. They could still take the money, squander it, and Dennis Dyack the project, which is now a verb, as I have coined it.
Yeah, I disagree with that phrasing. But, you know, I think Dennis really is a very creative guy, and I think it sounds to me like the way this company Precursor that they've set up, it kind of gets around the problems that he created at Silicon Knights, where he was involved in management and stuff like that, and maybe wasn't very good at that stuff. And it gets to a kind of game that I feel like they're much more comfortable making. They've made it before creatively, the same people, a lot of them are still involved with it. And it's, again, it's a kind of game that nobody else is really making, and I'd like to see them at least try. And I don't know if it would turn out well or not, but I know that if they don't make it, it won't turn out anyway. And I would like to, I'd like to see them get a chance to at least attempt it. And then we'll really know, you know, whether that was a fluke or maybe it's something that, you know, these guys actually are good at doing. So that's kind of how I felt about it. And I thought, you know, I'm just really curious about this. And to me, whether I back a Kickstarter or not, a lot of it comes down to just how curious am I about this thing. It's not necessarily how much I want it. It's how much I would like to know more. And the only way I'm going to learn more is if they actually get to make it. And then the other thing, which I feel like they should have been more transparent about this probably, but clearly they've lowered their fundraising goal in the second Kickstarter and the one that's ongoing. And the reason they're able to do that is because they got some outside funding. So that to me makes it much more realistic that they might actually get this thing finished.
What's their goal now?
It's $750,000. It was like 1.2 million or something.
Yeah, it was a completely unrealistic number for that.
Yeah, and that was for one episode.
Yeah, there was no way in hell.
Yeah. So I don't know how much external funding they have, but clearly they have gotten some. And I don't know if it may be matching. It may be contingent upon the Kickstarter succeeding. Who knows? We're not going to know those kinds of terms. But I think knowing that makes it a lot more likely that this might actually happen. It also gives them a certain amount of accountability to someone beyond the unnamed anonymous Kickstarter backers who seem so easy to rip off.
Yeah, who have no recourse if this thing goes, you know, to human too.
Yeah, so if they have a publisher contract, if they have venture capital, presumably they have something probably a little more binding and with something with a little more oversight with whoever that is. So that lends it an air of legitimacy that a lot of other Kickstarter games don't have. So there's that too. And ultimately, this is the kind of game I would love to be able to play on my Wii U. And I'm not sure that I'm going to if this game doesn't get funded. So that's part of it as well, you know. But anyway, I just kind of wanted to address that because there were a lot of people asking about it. And, you know, if it sounds like something you might be interested in, go check it out. It doesn't hurt to read about it, and you're welcome to decide that it's a bad idea. But I've said before, I think the pile-on for Dennis Dyack is ridiculous, and I think he is a talented person, and and he's surrounded by other people who are also talented, and I think they're interested in making something here that is potentially very special, potentially a complete bomb. But, you know, the not knowing is kind of the fun of it, right?
That's the grenade you're juggling.
Yeah, exactly. It is. So anyway, check it out if you haven't. It's an interesting project. I think it's worth looking into. Okie doke. Well, that's going to be the end of new business. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got your listener mail, and a very fine batch it is.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up, we have a review for Cloudberry Kingdom on the Wii U by Curtis Bonds. I just talked about it, but Cloudberry Kingdom is a procedurally generated platforming game. You get a different experience every time, which we know has never ever caused poor experiences in a game. Thankfully, the kingdom keeps this perfect streak alive.
Never, ever, ever.
And we have a preview for Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell Blacklist on the Wii U by Justin Baker. Let's talk Splinter Cell. Well, there's no offline multiplayer, but hey, wait, it's got online.
All right, we also have a review mini for Naze no Murusame Joe for 3DS Virtual Console.
Just Joe.
By Danny Bibbins. As a samurai of the shogunate, a big part of the job is to eliminate stone statues given life by extraterrestrials, of course. A fast-paced action game bearing some similarities to the original Legend of Zelda, this Famicom Disk System game, the inspiration for Takamaru's Ninja Castle. You're just laying on the Japanese pretty thick in this one, James. Never made its way out of the land of the rising sun. Thankfully, our man in Japan has his review of the 3DS Virtual Console release.
I would love for this to be an import release over here in the West.
I'd love for James to stop putting Japanese text exclusively in my
You know what, fine. I'll just write yours in Japanese next week.
All right, we have a review also of Mario and Luigi Dream Team for the 3DS by our own Neil Ranahan. We talked about Alpha Dream's important games last week. Koto Battle, Tengai, no Moribito. But it seems like they're busy still making these Mario and Luigi things. Neil seems to think it's okay. I guess we can forgive them for now.
This week we also had the launch of Nintendo World Report Powered Off Issue 8. It's been 8 months since Nintendo World Report started this magazine format monthly, and Nick Bray, for some reason, keeps asking me to write things. This month I talked about stupid stuff glowingly. We also have a discussion of Game Gear Sonic games and an alarming amount of Animal Crossing content.
Oh, so it's sort of like my 3DS friends list.
Yeah, I hope we can convince some people to check out Powered Off, because it's actually really cool. It's a PDF, it's totally free, and it really does look like a magazine. It's very nicely laid out, and it has some good content that's from the website, but also some original stuff. And James, in particular, seems to be writing original content for it almost every month.
And finally, we have a review, Undead Bowling for the 3DS eShop by Kim Keller. Last week, Kim absolutely destroyed the very foundations of Western society with a breakdown of an M-rated bowling game where you bowl for zombies and may in fact be imprisoned in this hellscape of an infested bowling alley. Based on our high praise, you should go ahead and get ready to bowl for your life.
Alright guys, well, you can check out Undead Bowling and Powered Off, the PDF magazine, and lots more stuff over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. This feels like the first time in a little while that we've done a whole mailbag. And as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Guillaume has the first email.
Jason0278 writes, "One of my favorite series introduced on the Wii was Endless Ocean. I played both and find them to be very different games. I prefer the original to the sequel. A single giant ocean with fewer goals, more freedom, better music, and less gaminess than the bigger but more goal-oriented sequel, Blue World. I think this series would be a great match with Wii U. HD graphics and gamepad photography would suit the game very well. What are your thoughts on the Endless Ocean series? Do you prefer one over the other? And do you have any specific ideas that you hope to see employed in a possible second sequel on Wii U?"
It's a great idea.
I've only played the sequel, actually, and not that much of it, really. I'm not sure, you know, like, HD graphics would improve the experience, I'm sure, because the game seems to be all about immersion, no pun intended. And, yeah, like, I'm sorry. But I think that what Nintendo really would have to work on is perhaps, like, the animations and the way that you interact with the fish, because in Blue World you use the pointer basically, right? And the game would ask you, you know, play with the fish and caress them or something like that. And
what?
It was just,
what game are we playing? The same game?
There is this kind of Nintendogs thing, because they have a, it's like a handheld thing and it emits electromagnetic waves or something.
Faster
Shut up, James. But yeah,
that's
like
it. Yeah,
you had to play with them, but it used a pointer And that didn't feel very right at all. Like, it just, and not for the reasons that James thinks, it didn't feel you were actually interacting with them, you know? Like, you were just shaking the Wiimote and that was that.
I mean, to me, Blue World is an interesting game because it has game to it. If it was just swim around the ocean, I feel like I'd get bored really fast and it would just be kind of a, you know, it would be more of just an interactive screensaver. To me, though, Nintendo already has a possibility here, which makes me think of the, I can't remember what they called them. The 3D camera things they did about, you know, a few months ago where, you know, they did like the one where you went through Japan and you could just tilt.
Oh yeah, the panorama view.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, sure. They could almost just do a bunch of panorama view style things with it if they didn't want to make it very gamey. I mean,
well, yeah, they could turn it into more like a Pokemon Snap thing. So you're on rails and maybe they even use real video footage, just like the panorama view, except they incorporate this sort of gameplay to it where you're taking pictures of things.
Well, I mean, they could put, you know, CG fish through the environment, and if the game's not really having to render most of it, those fish could look really good because it's just a fish. I mean, they could put interactive things into the video, but it seems like that'd be a really quick way to make an endless ocean style experience.
Yeah, I mean, it would be cool to be able to do a real tour of real areas, especially way deep down in the ocean, where like you wouldn't even be able to dive. That'd be really cool.
You would be stuck on rails, but it would be the immersive experience.
Mm-hmm. Let's call it James Cameron's Endless Ocean 3.
Let's not call it James Cameron's anything, because then we'll
Aliens of the Deep.
We'll have to listen to him talk about it for 40 minutes at E3 and not show us anything.
I really liked the exploration elements of Endless Ocean 2 because it is such a three-dimensional environment that you're in.
Right.
It's almost like a spacewalk or something.
Right.
You know, like, cause you have so much freedom to go up and down.
Well, I would say even more so than a spacewalk. Cause on a spacewalk, you're still tethered to whatever it is you're walking on. So you don't drift away.
Well, it's good in a sense because it gives you certain constraints. And in a spacewalking game, you could also add on, you know, the rockets, the MMUs and stuff like that that allow you to, you know, for short periods of time, you could go off tether potentially.
Right.
So I still think there's a lot of potential in that. And actually, I would love to have a spacewalking game that is sort of patterned after Endless Ocean, because I think there's a lot of overlap in design there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Endless Ocean is such a great chill out game. It's something that, like, when the first one came out, I don't think I was in the right part of my life to appreciate something like that. And so it didn't hold a lot of interest for me. But by the time the second one came out and I finally tried it after so many recommendations, I really appreciated just how relaxing it is. But also, there is a sense of wonder and mystery as you go down into the ocean, and you never quite know what you're going to find down there, even if it's a repeat dive. And I love that, you know, it was a series of distinct environments they had created, and each one had totally different stuff. And I love going down there and finding the combinations of really cool and unusual animal life, but also the plant life. And then also like the weird human artifacts that you find down there.
That you pillage for cash.
Yeah, like they had like ancient ruins you would get, like underwater castles and stuff that you would go through. And I'd like to see, you know, going through the Titanic, going down into those weird volcanic vents where the creatures live that like breathe phosphorus and crazy stuff like that, all the extremophile animals. I like the idea of like it takes you to a place that you so rarely visit in any video game, and it lets you interact with it in a way, even if it's almost all observational. Like, I think, you know, using the pointer or a touchscreen or something to like pet the fish is really stupid. Right. For me, it's just, I just want to go down there and look at it, see it from different angles, watch it animate, watch it run away from me, try to get close enough to take a picture without scaring it. Like, that stuff is still cool.
I do wish that I would wish that they would take the gaminess element away a little bit. Like, Blue World had you basically, like, buy better equipment to go, to dive deeper or to stay longer in the ocean. And I thought that kind of stuff only prevented me from actually enjoying the game.
Well, so I think that's not so much gaminess as it is gatekeeping.
Right.
It's there to instill the sense of progression.
But why put gates? I don't.
Well, because otherwise the game would be like 25 minutes long.
Well, they would have been a great 25 minutes, though. As it stands right now, I've never finished a game. At some point, I was like, okay, I've had enough. I'm tired of...
I mean, I never felt like the game really put a terrible barrier in your way in terms of money until the end where it's like, now we need to buy dynamite to blow a hole in this wall. Because it's like, you need 100,000. It's like, well, no. Game, no, you can get lost. And that was where I stopped.
Why did this game suddenly have a Triforce quest?
Yeah, it's like it's suddenly the amount of money you needed for this one thing to blow a hole in a wall became absurdist. Mm-hmm. And but I had already gone through like the convergence of the whales and that completely insane event. So
that was so awesome.
Oh, wow.
It was
I
awesome
need to go back.
And just like it made no sense and it was just, hey, the whales are here now. And you're like, what? And then just this big influx of whales comes in through a cave. You're like, all right, game.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Let's do this.
My favorite part of the game was actually the ice diving level when you're in the Arctic. Because you see such weird... You see a narwhal. You know, like, you just see the most bizarre things down there. But also, there are these weird sort of like submerged glaciers and weird ice flows. And you know, they're very three-dimensional structures underground. And so underwater. And it's just really interesting to dive around them and try to, at some points you find like holes where you can kind of go inside and then you find really weird stuff inside. And that stuff is so cool. And you just don't do that in other video games.
Right.
And that level, even aside from, there's some very superficial things they do, like, you know, you having limited air. And, you know, there's certain fish that are aggressive and they'll attack you and they can kill you. And that's dumb. That's a bad idea. But that stage had such this sense of like foreboding, like you really don't belong there and you probably shouldn't be there. And it feels like you're getting away with something just by exploring this world and by observing it. I've never experienced anything like that except maybe in like the Planet Earth series or Werner Herzog's Encounters at the End of the World. Like, that's such a cool experience to have in a video game. And I really do hope that they keep making this stuff, because it's unique.
Well, I mean, what's Arika doing right now?
That's a great question. I don't know. I hope they're making something like this, at least. Like, I think there's a lot to be done in even, like, the Pilot Wings franchise with stuff like this. If you make it less about doing aerial tricks and more about exploring, kind of like in Wii Sports Resort, that's more fun to me, but there just wasn't enough of it.
Yeah, and Pilot Wings Resort was just the opposite of what we wanted, I think. It was like, mm-hmm. Okay, here are tons of missions, but it's all on this one island that you've seen in other games, by the way. Have fun.
Oh, yeah. We're dumb. They're making 3D classics games. That's what Arika's doing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's a very good question, Jason. And I'm with you, man. I hope that happens. I'd love to see a sequel on Wii U. So I think James is going to have the next email.
Alex from Massachusetts writes, with so much talk about Miyamoto starting a new franchise and apparently planning on announcing it relatively soon, I was wondering if you guys could speculate a bit on what this might be. For instance, will he base the game around a character or an idea? What genre will he attempt to reinvent? Will it be a full new series or a small game with a small team that might not even hit retail? Will it be for the Wii U or 3DS? How active do you think Miyamoto's role will actually be as a man already in his 60s?
I think his role is going to be whatever he wants.
Right. I hope he's the director of a very small team.
Yeah, I would imagine if this is his project, he's the director of it. I mean, otherwise, it's not really his project.
Yeah.
It's maybe his idea that somebody else went out and made, but then it's not his project anymore.
Yeah.
Right. As for, like, will it be based around a character or an idea? I think usually his MO has been to base it around an idea, right? Like, if we listen to what he says,
Senior Jumpman, yeah.
Yeah, playing guitar, exploring caves, something like that.
There's all that, but you have to remember he's an artist by training, and I think he's right. still an artist at heart. I mean, he have you ever seen his signature?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's
he's
insane.
He's so visually creative, and I think he hasn't really probably gotten a good chance to be involved in that way in a long time. So if I put myself in Miyamoto's shoes and I finally have a little bit of independence and creative freedom that I might not have had in a long time, I would want to go back and create a new character.
Well, I mean, I think I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I think ultimately he has an idea, a gameplay idea, and then you get to build a world around that idea. I don't think he's going to go like, I'm going to go and draw a character and then I'll figure the fuck out later. Yeah, that's how you end up with Poochie.
Yeah, like usually I think he'll have an idea for gameplay and then try to make a character that fits it. And it's unlike, you know, an approach like, okay, we're going to make a platformer. What kind of furry critter are we going to put in it? You know?
Yeah. What inanimate object can we stick eyes onto?
Exactly.
It's not rare.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to be kind of going in the direction of favoring, you know, stuff that promotes interaction between people. Like, you know, I mean, even though, you know, Wii Music was not really successful, that seems to be kind of the stuff that gets his blessing lately. That's kind of what he's going for. And, you know, not necessarily so much telling a story, but kind of getting people, he's very much for ideas, but he's also kind of for breaking boundaries and trying to figure out new ways of doing stuff with existing hardware.
I think ultimately one question we can settle with relative ease is that whatever project he is making is almost invariably on the Wii U.
Yes.
And I think the investors would have a riot if it was a 3DS game. And not because it wouldn't make them a ton of money on 3DS, because there's a lot of 3DSs out there. For reference, 2% of the population of Japan owns a copy of Animal Crossing.
Wow.
That's absurd.
I guess for my opinion or my speculation on what Miyamoto might be working on, I do feel like it'll be probably a download game. But mainly because of the scope of it. You know, not because they're trying to push eShop with Miyamoto in particular or anything like that. I just feel like what he's talked about is that it would be maybe a smaller scale game, and maybe it's something that they would not feel comfortable selling at retail, which I think is great. It's something.
What's that barrier? Because that Wario game did.
Yeah, I know, and it shouldn't have, but I do feel like I wish Nintendo, would, and they have done some things like Dylan's Rolling Western and stuff like that. It may not be what I am looking for on the eShop. But they've done a few things, but those are still mostly made by outside developers, and Nintendo's first party teams have not really done a whole lot in that vein. And I'm kind of curious to see them be a little more experimental, you know, kind of mimic the indie scene a little bit and just like, here's a thing. It's a simple idea, but we're only going to charge $5 or $10 for it. And it's something that you've never seen before. Cause it's a very tight production, and we're trying to do one thing really well, and I'd love to see him do something like that, not on the scale of like Ika-chan by Pixel, which is like a game that's about 30 to 45 minutes long. I hope it's more than that, but I also don't really see it being a narrative game in the sense that it has like a really strong start, middle, and end. I feel like it's going to be something a little more creative, and I think Miyamoto, if you look at the stuff he's done in recent years, a lot of it is kind of like educational almost in a sense, or it's more about kind of getting a certain kind of interaction out of people more than it is telling a story. I think he would love to go back to the sort of creative space of something like Wii Music, but do it with better execution. And I'm not saying this will be related to Wii Music, but if you think about it, he was trying to be like, hey, what if we could make a game that would let anyone create music that sounded good, even if they have no training whatsoever, and it's very easy to play. You don't have to have like really strong timing or have to become super skilled at it. It's an admirable idea. The problem is it doesn't actually sound good, right? So I could see him going for a different flavor of that, maybe something, you know, totally unrelated to music, but like, what if I could take this somewhat familiar, maybe even mundane aspect of everyday living and make it fun and make it more interactive and make it something that people could get excited about? And I could totally see him going in that direction. I mean, that, look at Animal Crossing, like all of that came out of his original ideas for gardening and stuff like that. So yeah, that's kind of how I see him going with it.
I agree.
You know, like the question about how, you know, like he's in his 60s, does he still have it? I don't, you know, like there's so many movie directors or writers.
Well, John's in
or,
his 70s and he's still going. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like I don't think that Nintendo, I don't think that Miyamoto would have lost his touch or whatever. Like I'm sure he's still full of ideas. I just have no idea what it could be.
Yeah.
You know, I never get the impression that I don't know if it's a touch thing, it's just the energy to keep going. I don't get the impression he lacks that. Even when he makes, you know, facetious declarations of retirement, they're energetic. I think ultimately it's a question of, does he go hands off a bit with the actual development of the game in order to facilitate experience transfer? I think really that's more where his age may come into play. I think there may be a certain desire by him to back off and allow younger developers or people that he picked as sort of, you know, talented individuals to stretch their own wings while he sort of keeps an eye over them.
Totally, but I also feel like he's been talking about doing that for about a decade. And yeah. I feel like this new thing that he's working on is probably the opposite of that, is that he wants to be more hands-on. He wants to be closer to the
really
metal.
Being more hands-on would be a means to facilitate this experience transfer. I mean, even Alnima wasn't directly overlord of the last Zelda game. The last two.
Yeah.
I mean, so how far removed was he from that in dealing with people who were younger developers on that project? I mean,
right. So you picture him being like, okay, here's how you have a new here's how you create a new idea for a game.
No, I don't think it's anything that, let's do this by the books kind of thing. I think it'd be his idea where he came in and he brought in people he wanted to work with and said, this is the idea I want to make a game about. And, you know, maybe they workshop it together. Maybe they sort of develop it. Maybe they contribute, you know, supplementary pieces to the concept. Or maybe even one of them came with the idea and he said, I like that. Let's run with this. I mean, he's not the only person at that company who can generate ideas. But he's the only person at that company who can go, I like that idea. I want to make the game. Mm-hmm. Except, I mean, I guess Iwata could if he so desired. But, I mean, it's... I view this more as a, you know, this is a project that he's going to be intimately involved with, but maybe with his age, he hands off important duties to people while he directly supervises versus supervising through, you know, his handful of adjuncts, you know, his direct reports. Something where he gets to work with one step down in terms of the company that he normally works with directly.
Okay, well, we've successfully sucked all the fun out of this question, so let's move on. John Lindemann, please read the next email.
All right. Another Chris in Chicago writes, so I'll eventually be picking up a Wii U, but I was wondering how the Virtual Console emulation is on it. I feel the Wii has great emulation, but I've heard that there are some display problems with the HDMI of the Wii U. Is this true? How do the games look on a TV, and how do they look on the gamepad?
I haven't had any problems.
Yeah, no, I think initially there were some problems with the HDMI connection. Like, some people had overscan issues. For some reason.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think those have been fixed in one of the recent firmware updates.
That wasn't a Virtual Console thing. That was a Wii system settings problem.
Yeah, but I don't see what else he could be talking about. And yeah, like that, at some point they added the ability to adjust the screen of the Wii U to your TV screen. So that's gone. You know, like there's no more problems.
Yeah, I've been very happy with it. I haven't spent a ton of time with Virtual Console, and when I do, I usually play it on the gamepad. And that looks fine. It works really well, actually. So I've played a fair bit of like Kirby's Dream Land 3, which I'd never played before. So that's been a new experience. And that game has a really cool art style, and it looks great on the gamepad. I played some Super Metroid, played like a very little bit of Balloon Fight, I think. I've played maybe 30 minutes of Earthbound so far because I just haven't had time. But all that stuff looks great on the gamepad. And Super Metroid I played, though, mostly on the TV, and that looked great on the TV, too. So I haven't had any problems with it. You know, and they added save states, which is something that you don't have on Wii. And, yeah, I think it's great. It's just, it's a very limited selection. You have to keep that in mind if you're picking up the system thinking, oh, I'm going to get a whole bunch of Virtual Console stuff on there. I mean, the library is growing, and they've just announced a few things like Mario 3 and, you know, a couple other interesting things that are coming out on it. I guess Tecmo Bowl is coming out.
There's a couple of things, you know, like I think I'm not an emulation purist or anything. Like I don't have all the original systems that I compare to in a CRT TV. you know, like I'm, but all the games look good enough to me. I guess the problem that I have is that, you do, well, now I just find that there's like an overabundance of controllers. Like I wish that I could use my Wii U Pro controller for when I'm playing games, VC games on the Wii in Wii mode, you know?
Yeah.
I mentioned having problems controlling Super Metroid last time. I had to change the controls, but at least I have the possibility to change the controls now, unlike on the Wii Virtual Console. So that's a plus. But at the same time, the Wii U Pro, I'm not convinced is a very good controller for SNES games.
Well, and remember, the Pro controller on Wii U is not really designed for Virtual Console specifically, whereas on the Wii, the original Wii, the classic controller was designed primarily for use as a Virtual Console controller.
Yeah.
And I think you can still use a Wii classic controller or Pro or classic controller Pro on Wii U to play Virtual Console games. You just hook it up to a Wii remote and play with that. The Pro controller is more ergonomic and it's a better controller overall, but you're right. The button placement's a little weird. It's less akin to a Super Nintendo controller. But, you know, you can still plug in a classic and use that even on Wii U.
Yeah, it's just I'm a little bit annoyed that, you know, like the Wii U is supposed to, well, is backwards compatible with the Wii, but I still have all these controllers lying around from the past gen and this gen. It's a little bit much.
The gamepad also is a pretty good Virtual Console controller.
Yeah. No, it is. It is.
It works very well, I think.
One last thing that you might want to know is that because you're using an HDMI connection, when you go into Wii mode, at least it's the case for me on my TV, I would have to change the settings to 4x3 and to like 480p before I go into Wii mode. Otherwise, it's just going to stretch the screen if I play a Virtual Console game in Wii mode.
Yeah, you don't have to. You can play the game stretched out to widescreen. And in fact, I usually do that because I'm lazy.
Yeah. Well, I do that too when I'm lazy, but it doesn't look good. And that's one thing that you might want to do, that you might want to know before going in. I know that I kind of regretted the decision to transfer my Wii games to the Wii U just because it's more complicated to play my VC games in you know, and having the graphics more look more like they're supposed to look, you know.
Was that not the case for you on Wii also?
No, I think because I was using components cable and not an HDMI cable. My TV was not changing the aspect ratio itself, so I could just change on the TV, you know, I could switch modes like from zoom to like it had different options, but I could make it 4x3 just by using the TV remote, which was much more convenient. And now I can't do that anymore.
Okay. So that may be also a function of whichever TV you're using.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't know a way to test that without, you know, testing it. So
without buying a whole bunch of TVs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's a fair point, but there are a number of issues with using Wii mode on the Wii U. It's not perfect, But if you look at the complete lack of backwards compatibility on PS4 and Xbox One, I'm actually very thankful for Wii Mode. And I think having all of that, I think being able to play Wii games on my Wii U is just nice because I don't have to have a Wii hooked up anymore. You know, I transferred all my stuff over. And I think having all of that stuff just sitting there on the SD card ready to go anytime I want, and it's on the newest Nintendo system I have along with all this other stuff, you know, it's a little bit extra hassle. It takes a couple extra minutes to get into a Wii Virtual Console game, but I like that I at least have the option, and I don't have to like change cables and turn on a completely different system in order to do it. And you can still, when you're done with the game, they added a button in Wii mode that takes you back to the Wii U.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty smart.
Yeah, it's very smart. So you don't even have to like reset the system to go back to the main. To the main thing. So you can very seamlessly jump back and forth between Wii U games and Wii games. And I mean, people shit on it, but again, it's not even an option on other consoles. And I think all things considered, it's actually pretty well implemented, and I've used it a fair bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to keep in mind if you're a current Wii owner. So I mean, my opinion is I recommend that you transfer it, but I guess it depends on your particular setup and what you want to get out of it.
Right.
Okie doke. I'm going to read the next email. It's from Kelvin in Montana. With the recent releases of Earthbound and Shantae on Virtual Console, what other rare or very expensive physical games would you like to see released on the VC? I know I could never afford the physical copies of these two games, but now that they are available on VC, I am thrilled that many gamers like myself can have the opportunity to play through these gems. I would love to see the N64 Rare titles show up, especially Conker's Bad Fur Day. Also, if they get the GameCube VC going, I want to see Skies of Arcadia, Cube of War, and Ikaruga.
Stadium events.
John, no, Stadium events is not valuable because people want to play it.
No.
No.
Because I've played it. It's awful.
Yeah. All of Kelvin's choices are excellent. Unfortunately, the Rare game's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I think Donkey Kong 64 probably.
Kong 64 is fully and wholly owned by Nintendo, yes.
Yeah, but most of the Rare games went over to Microsoft.
The ones you want to play.
Yeah, like Blast Corps is so good, and Conker is definitely a great game. I would love to play through that again. But there's a whole bunch of them. Jet Force Gemini probably is one of my very, very top N64
games.
That's
the one that hurts me the most. I mean, it really is, because it's just, it's such a weird game, and I don't think anybody ever actually beat the final boss.
Ever?
Yeah, I got to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never played it.
And Jet Force Gemini almost invented third-person shooters. I think it's I guess MDK probably is the more prototypical game, but Jet Force Gemini is so much more refined and so much better.
It also invented breast physics.
And just to throw another N64 game in the mix, because I do feel like it's a platform that was poorly represented on the Wii Virtual Console, and I think there's a chance for redemption here with a number of games, especially third-party stuff.
Pilot Wings 64. What the hell? Give it to us.
That's a good one. I was really disappointed when I found out when they announced Pilot Wings for Wii U Virtual Console, and then I found out it was the Super Nintendo version.
Well, of course it was.
Yeah. I think the 64 one's a lot better. But I was going to throw out Space Station Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I think the reason it's hard, or the reason we didn't see a lot of N64 games, just because I think it's hard to emulate. I mean, there's a lot going on in those carts, and a lot of them did their own kind of thing when they made their game. They just kind of went off and did something weird.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably a certain amount of just oddness in it.
Well, I was able to emulate N64 games on my GeForce graphics card on my computer in the year 2000. Nintendo can probably pull something together 13 years
later.
Yeah,
but a lot of those games barfed on those emulators. A lot of games just didn't work well at all. And emulators would have like custom code written to handle that game.
Well, they got Majora's Mask to work.
They did. And Majora's Mask is super weird, and I do wonder if, you know, they had to spend a lot of time on just that game.
I don't know, but it works great on Virtual Console, and there are bad emulated versions of that Nintendo released even. I'm sure it's a very challenging case, but they made it work.
The thing is, there's not a lot. If you look at the N64, there's not a lot of games that are super rare. It's not a console that's awash in titles that are really, really rare. I mean, I think Clay Fighters is super rare. And like, there's I think Soccer 2000's rare.
But who really wants to play those?
And Daikatana is rare. And as far as I know, that's the end of like the really rare N64 games.
Mm-hmm.
And except for Clay Fighters, nobody wants to play those games. I mean, fucking Daikatana.
Clay Fighters is not that good either.
No.
Yeah.
But it's a damn sight better than Daikatana.
I would really, really love for those Star Wars games to come back.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain amount of, like, Star Wars Pod Racer. It's a licensing nightmare, but it's a really good game.
That is great. And, I mean, if we're opening up the GameCube, man, I mean, Rogue Leader, I mean, just right off the bat, you know, the original Super Monkey Ball is so good. There's a lot of stuff like that. I still have copies of those, but my Wii's not hooked up anymore, and I would love to have them on, you know, just there, ready to go anytime. I don't have to hook up a bunch of stuff to do it. And especially if they're going to add enhancements, which on Wii U they have. So I think there's a potential for that still.
If you want to get to like really rare stuff, you have to step away a little bit, because even the GameCube doesn't have a ton of stuff that's just...
I want to say Gacha Force is pretty rare.
It is. And there's a handful of games that are just... You know, it just happened to be there weren't that many of them made.
Yeah. I mean, Skies of Arcadia is, I mean, you know, Kelvin pointed that out, but...
I bought that game the day it came out, and I don't think I saw it in stores again. but there's not a ton of rare games out there.
Yeah, there's not really one rare game that I'd like to play or that I really want to see released on Virtual Console, but I would love the opportunity to not have to spend money on a Saturn to play Saturn games. But again, like, that console is supposed to be, you know, like, mythically tough to emulate.
Yeah, no, it's been solved.
It has?
There on PC, there's an almost perfect Saturn emulator. And there have, it's been out for a couple years.
It was obscenely difficult to figure out how to solve that particular console.
Yeah, but it's already been done, so I don't care anymore how hard it was to do. So it was hard to go to the moon, but we did it. And it's been done.
Yeah, it's super easy to go back, isn't it, Johnny? Yeah, your example kind of sucks shit, Johnny.
I just want a virtual console that allows me to have the kind of experience that you get when you go to the classic games room at PAX, you know?
Yeah.
And you just...
You want to play Demolition
Man. You can just,
man.
Like, pick up any kind of strange crap that you find and have a go at it, and it's just, like, it's wonderful.
For me, I would want a bunch of the Famicom Disk System games we didn't get.
Yeah,
and I don't care. I don't care if they're translated. You know, I can get
most people do.
And you know, anything on the 64DD as well.
It's not like I can read Japanese at a great level. I mean, I wouldn't be much better off than anybody else.
Yeah.
But I mean, how much text do you really think an FDS game had?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's you know, like there's systems like the Saturn. It's not just that it was hard to emulate, but also like if you buy one, there's issues with the memory card. Like it has to have a battery in there.
Oh yeah, it's a piece of shit. It's a terrible system.
Yeah, and the FDS, like apparently there's this elastic strap that keeps breaking. So I'm not a collector, and I would not want to keep up like to try to, you know. I wouldn't want to do maintenance on one of these classic consoles. I just want access to the games.
Yeah.
So that would be fantastic.
I just want to see the games that I already like, even if I already own them, to just come out more quickly.
Mm-hmm. What I especially want are the ones that got away, like the games that I rented or borrowed or just like played or even just saw in magazines when I was a kid, but I never got a chance to try them for myself.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like games that I'm familiar with enough. Like I don't go to Virtual Console hoping to be educated about games that I've never heard of before, there's just plenty of stuff I'm exposed to that I've just never really gotten to really delve into. And that's exciting for me. Stuff like Shantae is a perfect example. I pretty much know what Shantae is. I just never was able to play it until now.
Hey, how about Chrysalis?
Oh,
I don't
James.
Care. I don't even care what version it is anymore.
Yeah.
Just put a version out there. Nah,
I care. It needs to be NES.
But at this point, I mean, it's SNK, so you'd probably have to talk to the company that owns the company that owns the company that owns SNK.
Yeah.
But
if you want a Neo Geo, buddy, they got thousands of them for you.
Or just wait for SNK to go bankrupt again and buy them out.
And in fact, if you even want a handheld Neo Geo, they have those too.
We don't talk about the Neo Geo Gold here, John.
Magician Lord, you don't want a fifth version of that? Come on, buddy.
Why couldn't Demon's Crest have been a Neo Geo game? We would have had it years ago.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it'd be more probably, you know, I'm kind of the opposite, where for me, it'd be more of the games from Japan that we never saw. Like, you know, anything for the 64DD or anything like that would be pretty cool.
Doshin the Giant?
Two.
The European-only version of Doshin the Giant.
Yeah, I mean, or even earlier versions of games that were significantly changed for North America.
Such as?
It's always pretty cool. I don't even know. That's the thing. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. There's games. I'm looking for stuff that I don't even really know about or I'm not even aware of.
Honestly, I think if they ever really got the FX chip emulation working, I think they could and might actually release Star Fox 2. Just like, hey guys, we made this, you know, it's pretty much finished.
I mean, I've seen versions of it that are basically playable. I mean,
it would not take that much work to tie the ends together and make it a real game. And people have done it. I'm sure Nintendo is more than capable of doing it. And how much interest would there be in Star Fox 2 coming out on Virtual Console?
A ton, yeah.
Hey, a Star Fox game that doesn't involve bullshit.
Well, it had some bullshit.
Yeah, definitely. From the videos I've seen, there's a little bit of bullshit.
There's a little bit, but it's not the same. It's different bullshit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to play Yonoid without Yonoid in it, but...
Oh, the Japanese version?
Kamen no Ninja Hanamaru. But it's actually fucking impossible. I've tried playing it. It is a game designed by the evilest person to ever live.
Speaking of something that might actually happen, they've mentioned GBA is going to be supported on Wii U Virtual Console for some damn reason.
Just because.
I would fucking love to play Ninja 5-0.
Yeah,
that game is really expensive and really hard to find, and I've heard it's just awesome.
That would murder the value of that game almost instantly.
I used to own that game, and then I traded it in.
So Guillaume, isn't it kind of like Bionic Commando?
I could answer this question if Bionic Commando ever made it to the Virtual Console at any point, but it never did. So I've never played it. I'm sorry.
Guillaume!
Listen to what you're doing to James, Guillaume.
But yeah, like you've got this grappling hook. You can swing from it, if I remember correctly, and you're a fucking ninja, so... Yeah, like it's a little bit like the Shinobi games where you're rescuing hostages and you must not kill them and you must not let, you know, I don't know. I have very dim memories of the game. I don't remember falling in love with it like I did other action games, which is probably why I traded it in. But no, it would be definitely nice to be able to just grab that for cheap.
Well, there's a few ideas for you, Kelvin. Hopefully we'll see some of that stuff at some point. Okay, so that's all the time we have this week for listener mail, but we've been getting a lot of other questions. We will definitely get to some of those, as well as anything new that comes along. So if you'd like to have us answer your question or just talk about whatever topic you can think of that you would like us to talk about, you can send that in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And there's a link in the show notes as well over at NWR. Also wanted to give everyone a reminder that Retroactive is gearing up for Pandora's Tower. I just got my copy today, and I'm very excited to play that. And the four of us are planning to talk about that probably in about 2 to 3 weeks, right before the big episode 350. I don't know what we're going to do for that. We still need to talk about it. It's probably, I have to tell you, I feel like 350 is probably going to be fairly low key, because it's just, it's a bad time of year with people traveling and moving and stuff like that. At this point, all four of us have moved this year. We've worked really hard to keep the show going weekly at this point, and we've really stretched sometimes to get things pulled together so that we can keep the show going, because it's just been a logistical challenge this year. And we just haven't had a whole lot of extra time to plan for a big event like that. But we will have an episode 350, that much I can promise you. It will take place. But I don't know what's going to be on it. But it's coming up fairly soon. But like I said, probably before that, we'll do retroactive. And the thread is already up, and there will be a link in the show notes for that as well. And if you have played Pandora's Tower, or if you would like to play it, or if you plan to play it for the feature, I hope you will go there and drop some thoughts. Even if you've never played it and you just have questions about it, that's a good place to do that as well. And that might sort of get the conversation going as well.
I'm about 3 hours into it. It's pretty fun. Like, seriously, you guys, don't miss out on
this.
It's
an RPG. Don't worry about it.
It's great. No, it's not.
Shut up.
It's the most RPG-inist RPG.
James, are you thinking about playing through it again or just dabbling?
I'll at least play a couple chapters.
Cool. Just to refresh.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, very much looking forward to talking about Pandora's Tower coming up pretty soon. I hope you are as well. And as for next week, it looks like things have finally caught up with us, and we probably won't have a normal show for you guys. It's just Guy and I will both be out of town, and I'm just not sure that we're going to be able to pull any new content for you. We might do a kind of a classic retro episode that you might not have heard before if you're fairly recent to the show. We might try to fill in with some kind of weird alternate programming, but it probably won't be a normal new episode of RFN. Be a little bit of a vacation for us, just necessary due to circumstances. But we will definitely be back in 2 weeks with, I'm hoping, a pretty normal episode for you, and it'll be packed to the gills with lots of new stuff. So that's all. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks, James, John, and Guillaume, for doing the show with me every week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Later. Keep it real.
Just imagine yourself as a 60-something Japanese man who has made several classic arcade games.